podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello, it is the weekend and it's John Gibbons hosting. I'm joined by Cathy Long, by Ian Salmon, by Paula Murphy and by James Sutton to talk about the champions of England losing a game of football. They lost to Manchester City last night. But we're going to talk about the champions first, because I've just established just before we went on that none of these four people have yet spoken on the Anfield Wrap about the fact that Liverpool are champions of England. So how could I make them first talk about the before I talk about that? So we'll start with you, Cathy, as I said your name first. How did it feel, and how does it still feel?
Oh, it felt really strange. Like, I knew I'd be emotional when this happened. And of course, I'd always imagined that I'd be on the cop, you know, I'd be crying with all the people around me. You know, we'd all be hugging. I mean, I knew how emotional it was going to be. And the guy who sits like next but one to me, Steve, said this a while ago. He said, me and him had this moment earlier in the season when we looked at each other and we just knew it was on. And he had tears in his eyes. And he said, I knew that was the moment when you knew what it meant to me. And he's a bit younger than me. So it was like the whole thing of like, you've not seen this happen before, so I want it for you, you know. So it was just really weird sitting on the sofa and sort of imagining all of this. And I had a complete emotional meltdown about an hour after it happened, I think, you know. And then decided this is like, it's sort of like a slow burn. You know, I remember after Istanbul, literally being happy for a full year. Like, it felt like every moment of it. And yeah, I'm sort of still feeling like that's going to be the case with this one, you know. Buzzing, but in a strange kind of way.
I mean, that's a really good point, isn't it, James? Because we do get to enjoy this for the whole year, just like Istanbul. We were European champions for the whole year, just like now we're still European champions and you still get to enjoy that. I know I spoke to a couple of people who've said, oh, yeah, it's just not quite sort of hit me yet. Just be patient. It's fine. We're going to be champions for ages.
I'm enjoying every single minute of it, mate, truth be told. I haven't stopped singing songs. I haven't stopped smiling. I haven't stopped being as unbearable as I can possibly be to anyone that will give me the time of day. But also, I've got a real sense of relief about it as well. And I feel vindicated. I feel like, you know, we've been telling anyone that will listen for the past 30 years that we're the best team in the world. And, you know, I haven't always backed that up with trophies and with, you know, the type of football that we want. But right now we've got that, and God, it feels good. But there is a sense of relief, I think.
Ian, for you, was it up there when they won the FA Cup for the first time in 1965?
don't take that off him, mate.
I was dead zen. I was really calm. I was just kind of like, I didn't even watch the Chelsea City game. I sat in the garden with a glass of wine. I could hear what was going on because people were cheering in the background across the street. So I knew what was happening, came in for the penalty. I was kind of like, came to the end and went, yeah, there you go, job done. I went full on Ronnie Moran on it after that. I was kind of like, okay, job done. Now next season, do it again and put the Champions League with it. This is the job now. I just felt we're back where we're supposed to be. For me, the emotional moments, I don't feel I've enjoyed the win. I don't feel I've enjoyed the win at any point. Yes, it might creep up on me, but the moment that I enjoyed us winning the league was when Mo put the second goal against United. And at that point where I couldn't stop myself singing, now you can't believe us, we're going to win the league. That was the point where we won. Everything else after that was just up in the eye.
Just a procession. Yeah. I mean, Paul, it's a funny one for you, I guess, because, you know, you would have been abroad for when Liverpool won it, and obviously circumstances, you know, pandemics and things like that, you're now local for it. So in a strange sort of way, the pandemic's actually brought you closer to the city and sort of closer to the football team, but not quite close enough to go and see it.
Exactly. Well, it was really funny what you've just said, because I've lived for the last 6 years in Abu Dhabi, and I'm one of the sort of very early members of the official Overseas Liverpool Supporters Club. And we've actually got our own bar, and it's proper. Like, people who've come to visit me have gone in this bar and like, are you sure I'm not in town? It's run by two Scousers from Anfield. And in fact, we've done a little travelling cop a year or so ago. And so I wasn't with them. But I actually live in Cairo, and I know Cairo would have gone off. Yeah. I know it was, and I wasn't with them. I'm sitting in my mum's house and I'm watching this game half-heartedly on my laptop, and it went to 1-1, and I'm like, mother, and she went, are we ahead? I went, we're not playing. Then I had to explain to my mum what was going on. And then by the time I'd gone through the explanation, fireworks were going off in the street. My mum went, you better get a bottle of wine and get out there. There'll be a bevy. So I spent the next 3 hours in some neighbour that I've never even met crying my eyes out. It was great.
Absolutely fantastic. That was I thought we'd start with that because, you know, we do need to remain positive, even though Cathy did off by 4 goals last night. It was a frustrating game, really, because I thought they started well. Obviously, we hit the post at 0-0, and it just felt we seemed to get worse kind of as the Man City goals went in, and we never really figured out how to respond to those setbacks.
Yeah, I think it was a lesson in how to respond. You know, I think it's easy to read that game and think, oh, well, you know, they were straight out the bar, you know, flip-flops on or whatever. I don't really think it was that, but I think what we learned is that if you're even like a couple of percentage out, like in terms of physicality and intensity, you know, it's very difficult to win, because what we win with is that physicality, that intensity, that energy. And we have to be 100%, especially against a team like City, you know, even like a little bit out mentally, you've got no chance, because a team like City will overpower you. We might get away with it with certain other teams because they might be thinking, well, this is Liverpool and expecting us to score, you know. And I think that's what we learn from it, you know. We were very open as well, and I think we tried to just play our game, and then when it didn't happen early on and we didn't get the goals that, you know, we were so close to getting, then I think frustration probably set in, you know, especially when they did get the points. It didn't like a 4-0, but
yeah, I mean, it didn't really feel. I think Jurgen Klopp said after the game, well, it could have been 5-3, you know, on a similar night, James. It wasn't really a 4-0, but at the same time, you know, they took their chances and we didn't, and it just generally felt like they were just a little bit more up for it, you know, what they had to do at the start, you know, the guard of honor. Sorry, I was struggling. I was like, tunnel, is it?
the tunnel of love.
Yeah, exactly. They had to do the tunnel of love at the start, which they won't have enjoyed. And then you saw, especially the second and third goals, how much Sterling and Foden celebrated those. You know, how much it meant to them, how much they were up for it, and just Liverpool just couldn't quite match that intensity, I didn't think.
Yeah, I think that's what it boils down to. When you've got two, you know, almost immovable objects coming together, the one that has even the slightest little chink in its armour will inevitably fall apart. And it only has to be a small thing. And I think a lot of it did come down to motivation and intensity. And I watched Jurgen Klopp's post-match, you know, sort of interview, and I thought he was a bit. I know. I mean, I get he was angry and I get he was disappointed, but I think he went a little bit overboard. I didn't think he needed to be quite as harsh as he was. He was very, very mean.
I got a bit scared, you know. Like, I enjoyed it, but like I've obviously asked Jurgen questions before, and I just got like anxiety. Like, what if he does that to me?
But yeah, but also we haven't seen that side of him for such a long time. But yeah, I think how do you motivate these players for the rest of the season? Like, genuinely, how do you motivate them to the same standard? You can't. You know, the weight and the expectation of this City being on, and it is huge. I should know. I'm part of it. It's massive, and the relief that these players must have felt winning that title, and that just, you know, that exhilaration that they got from it. I don't know how you move forward from that and go back to competing when there's nothing, you know, there's nothing on the table. And yes, if they're professional footballers, yes, they should be going to Man City and putting in a good performance and perhaps not conceding 4 goals, but it's done and dusted, isn't it? You know, it's tough.
It's going to be interesting now from now on, and this isn't an old joke, Ian, and that the last one very much was, but this one isn't. I'm just going to say that, you know, back in the 70s and 80s, when the league was wrapped up, it wouldn't, you know, be unusual for Liverpool to lose a few games. And sometimes you'd see a league table at the end and it'd be lost five and three of them would come in the sort of last four games. So it's not an unusual thing. And I think also it is going to be a little bit tricky because they haven't got the supporters there. So, you know, the next sort of home game and things like that, it's Aston Villa on Sunday. That would have been a party atmosphere under normal circumstances. Instead, it's not. And it is going to be a challenge now, isn't it, for Jürgen to sort of, you know, to motivate them for the rest of the season. But they have got that points record maybe in their grasp, and that could be the thing that does it.
That's the one. I don't think it should be difficult for him to motivate them. Because the motivation is, you go out there, you win the next game. All season, we've been winning one game at a time, and that's what we've been doing. You go out and you win this one game, and you've got the points at the end of it. You can get the greatest amount of points anyone's ever had, which will probably not be beaten at any point. You can go the entire season having only lost and drawn two. And those two that you've lost is twice as many as you lost the previous season. You've only lost three in two seasons. The motivation there is to be the best you can possibly be. Last night, I listened to the beginning of AFQ before, and the first question was, are you arsed? And my answer was, yes, I'm really arsed. I mean, I'm really, really arsed. I don't like losing games of football. I didn't enjoy watching last night. I can't have a laugh about it. I can't think it's funny that Trent threw the ball into a space that was immediately going to be occupied by a City player, because we're better than this. Mm. And last night we were bad. I'd like Jürgen's interview at the end to be, what was the problem? We were very bad at football and City were very good. And I would like that to have been the entirety of the interview. I'd like him to have done rappers. I'm concentrating on coaching my team. We were bad, they were good for 5 minutes. That would have done me. We should have been. I don't think there's anything wrong with the attitude last night. The intensity might have dropped poor and got poorer and poorer. The rest of the season, the job is to win every one of those games, because next season started. The route to winning the title started last August with the very first game, and the our eye hasn't been off the ball ever since. And the lads get a get-out card, because you can't slag those lads off because they've given us everything for 2 years. But last night needs to be a blip. We can't have five more games where we don't win. We have to go into the rest of the season and go, okay, we are having the most points anyone's ever got, because this asterisk that everybody wants next to us is going to see no one's ever doing this bloody season again. And that's what needs to happen. I wasn't happy watching last night. I was bored through most of the second half. And credit where credit's due, Sterling's finish, that little drag back that he does, that's lovely. Yeah. And Foden's goal's a gorgeous piece of football. He's involved in that passing move four times. Brilliant football. If Bobby did that, we'd be raving about it. So credit to Phil Foden for the performance he put in on that. But we did get worse and worse with every goal they put in. I don't think his attitude, I don't think his head's going. I just think we were very poor. We just need to not do that again.
I love that Ian Salmon is a mentality monster. it's good to see it. You know, I mean, Ian talks there about not enjoying losing, and these footballers won't enjoy losing either, Paula, will they? You know, they haven't got to where they've got to, you know, in their careers, in their Liverpool careers, you know, over the last 2 years. If they're not asked, you know, about losing game of football, they'll want to put that right. They can on Sunday. We're going to talk about Sunday in part two, but generally speaking now, they'll be probably looking at each other in training today and going, we need to be better than that next time.
What's really interesting for me is, I wonder if Salah's goal that hit the post, if that had gone in, would we be talking about a completely different scoreline?
Yeah.
And I think there's a case to be made there. The other thing as well that staggered me, because I thought we looked that I think we had some industry, we had some creativity, but we just had no connection. It was disjointed all the way through, I felt. And yet when you look at the bare stats of shots on goal, shots on target, possession, it was, do you know, it was 49-51. It was almost tight down the line.
Yeah.
And yet, okay, gorgeous pieces of football accepted. It just didn't look that you know, those four goals, apart from the own goal, those four goals didn't look like a team that were only 1-2% ahead of us in possession. So I'm sort of less bothered. I'm surprised it wasn't worse. And that might be a little bit of heresy to say, but we are allowed an off day, and we had one, and we know it's not good enough. And I think he's going to go mad at them, and I don't think we'll be seeing it again anytime soon.
Let's all hope not. Has anyone got any positives from the night? Anything that you went, you know, that's a tick in the line with a lot of crosses on the other side.
Yeah. The captain was excellent.
Yeah, especially second half,
yeah.
He was the one person on the pitch who was determined this wasn't going to happen. And again, nothing wrong with the lads' mentality. It's not that they weren't arsed at all. It wasn't happening. But Jordan Henderson was determined to make sure as far as possible that we came back into it. And yeah, that speaks volumes about the character he's been in the last 2 or 3 years. And his entire
I think there's a positive in what they will have learned from that. Like that, you know, like I say, even if you're 1 or 2% slightly off.
Yeah.
You know, like you think you're being really intense, but it's bound to take the edge off it. As James said, you know, in terms of motivation, you still think you're motivated. You still think you're putting 100% in, but you realise if you put 98% in against a team like that isn't enough.
And that's what happened.
Learning that it's not a lesson. And as others were said, I don't see it happening again. I really don't.
Well, the first 20 minutes, their defence were absolutely terrified.
Yeah.
They did. Their defenders did not know what to do. We were playing some gorgeous stuff. Mane nearly scores. Salah nearly scores. We hit the post. There's real opportunities there. And I thought, and it was growing into a really lovely game of football. It was quite exciting. I love this rivalry. I really love this proper footballing rivalry that we've got now with Man City. Yeah. I find it really, really exciting because we haven't had that rivalry in a footballing sense for a long time. And it's lovely to watch. But yeah, after the first goal went in, it all just kind of fell apart, didn't it?
Do you remember when Pep Guardiola said after we'd played them, and he said this a couple of times in interviews when he's been interviewed both here and in Spain, and he said that, you know, you play Liverpool, And you think it's fine and you've got the ball, and the next thing you know, they're 3-0 up.
Yeah.
You know, and because that had happened to them at Anfield, and it was like, hang on a minute. He said, they score one, and then the next thing you know, they've scored three, and you don't understand how it's happened. And I think, you know, that easily could have happened in that first 20 minutes, the way we were playing again.
Yeah.
Well, he did it to us, basically. And he's trying to do that to us and wanting to do that to us. You say, because of this football and rivalry, he's been trying to go, okay, how do we do that against them and the manager?
The other big positive about tonight's game, it doesn't matter.
are we still champions, Ian?
We've won it already. There was a bit of commentary from Martin Tyler, I think, talking about the fact that it doesn't feel like a title winning. It doesn't feel like a title deciding game. It's like, well, it's not. Because we've won it. The title is decided. Yeah. Got it. Yeah. So that's the big thing. It was nothing. It didn't matter. But you can still be annoyed by things that don't matter.
Yeah. Just sort of round off, Paulo. We've all talked about, you know, what happens if intensity drops a little bit. And Jürgen's now got a positive example that he can point to for these players. I don't imagine that there are a group of footballers whose intensity drops lightly anyway. But he's now got an almost a working example of something he can point to and say, remember when we weren't quite at it and that happened. And I think, you know, that could be something that might be a positive, might be useful for him, not just this season, but next season, next 2 seasons, you know what I mean? That he's able to point to this performance to go, do you remember when you weren't quite at it and we lost 4-0 and it was crap?
Yeah, and I think having video of the game and being able to do the analysis, because when I teach PE, we do this sort of stuff when we're assessing practical performance. And even at our level, using apps on phones, it is amazing what you can pick up. So it will be really interesting to see how they look at their individual performance, their performance in groups. I thought the back four, for large part, it's like they'd never met. It was like they didn't know each other's name. And I'm, you know, when they see that as a collective, I'm sure they will watch it in their little groups. It'll be really interesting to make sure that they put that right. But they've got muscle memory. They've got enough knowledge. They've got enough intelligence and game savvy. I think it's just one of them.
Yeah, just John, one of them.
You're absolutely right, John. I think you learn more from losing than you do from winning.
From winning, yeah.
You learn far more about yourself, about the game, about... Yeah, you just do. It's hugely important for their development. Like you say, it's something to put a pin in and go, let's not do that again, any of you. because it was embarrassing.
Yeah. Well, lucky there. What a lucky team, because we've laid absolutely fuck off in about 2 years now. So yeah, let's learn while we can. That's the end of part one anyway. We've got some inserts now. Andy Heaton has been speaking to Clive Tilsley, who did commentary with us last night, and we were delighted to do so, about some of his classic commentary and some mementos that you can buy. Neil Lackington has been speaking to Jason Lee from the PFA about a report that's come out this week about racial stereotyping in commentary. And then Gareth Roberts has been up at Anfield as well. And after all that, we'll be back with the four people you have with us now to look ahead to the Aston Villa game. So don't go anywhere.
This is Andy Heaton for the weekend. I'm delighted to be joined on the line by Clive Tilsley. Clive's a friend of the show and has recently just done a commentary with us on Hot Mic, and has done other bits and bobs, and famously has voiced our two animations for our European Cup win and our league title lift, which we're very happy about. We've gone down brilliantly. Clive, thanks for coming on.
It's an absolute pleasure, and I think more credit should probably be given to Ruben Armstrong, who came up with the animation, and perhaps even to Divock Origi and Mo Salah, Trent Alexander-Arnold, for scoring the goals, because without them, none of this would have been possible.
They get enough credit, leave that. I mean, I take it on Ruben, but the players, they get enough credit.
Right.
And they're well
paid. Right. It's all enemy.
Yeah, exactly. 100%. Talking about defining moments, we've got you on for various reasons, but one of the reasons I want to talk to you is one of your new enterprises, commentarycharts.com. I think we've seen them online before, where your notes that you make on games that you've shown on Twitter and the other occasion have got a bit of a cult following, the detail and the craftsmanship. So you've decided to, go into business with them almost and do prints that you can send out. So do you want to tell us a little bit of the backstory around that?
Yeah, I prepare charts for every commentary game that I do. And obviously for the biggest games that I've commentated on, you know, back in the day, if any of you are old enough to remember the day when Champions League finals were live to the nation on ITV, I know it's a long, long time ago. Hello, and all that. I was that man. I was the guy who called those games, and it was a wonderful privilege to do it. My preparation notes for those games were particularly detailed. I would do a full A4 chart on the possibility of a penalty shootout. So you'd prepare words for the intro, because the studio would probably hand to you a little bit earlier at a Champions League final than they might for any other game. You prepare notes for the possibility of the trophy lift and so on. So there are plenty of them. They are particularly neat. I don't have many qualities in life, but my handwriting's pretty good. And they are an interesting memento, because if you look at the charts and the two lineups laid out as they are at kickoff time, they are a snapshot, not of your memory of the night, not of how the night turned out, not of those three goals in 6 minutes. They are a snapshot of kickoff time, before Paolo Maldini scored even. You know, that is what you're seeing. And so what we found is the people who bought prints of these charts, they hang them in the downstairs loo or in the study or wherever in the office, wherever they work. And then they tell their own story. You know, people say, "Whoa, what's that? You may not have been in Istanbul. You may have been watching a game at home with your dad, who's not even with us anymore. You may have been with somebody you shouldn't have been with. Who knows? But you'll have a particularly memory of the night, just as you have a memory of Kiev, you know, where you were when you were watching that game. Certainly you'll have a memory of where you were when you watched the final last year. So two of the first nine charts that we published are my commentary charts for Liverpool's last two Champions League / European Cup wins, 2005 and 2019. And you can see them laid out, the team lineups, who played, a little bit of the background to the game itself, how many goals each player had scored prior to kickoff and so on. So, yeah, they're there. They're in print. There will be a special Champions chart released the day after the season is over. So there is another Liverpool chart coming, but commentarycharts.com is the place to find them.
Yeah. So if you ever want to remember the night that you actually finally got caused your divorce, this is where you want to go and see them. No, I'm joking. I think they're brilliant. What's funny about it is that, and I can say this, and maybe you can't, is I looked at these, and I can tell from a distance, even from a thumbnail, what it is and who's written it. It's just the style and the typography and the care and love that's clearly gone into them. I mean, how do you feel when you look back at them? Because you did, obviously 2005 is now 15 years ago. I mean, how fresh in your memory is that game and actually putting your pre-game chart for that together and all the other big games? I mean, we can talk about Man United in 1999 if you really want. And also, Finn, that I'm curious to know which one sells better. And you've got to tell the truth.
99 is selling, is our number one seller at the moment. Oh. And 2005 is our number two seller. Last year's is our number three seller. So we do have a Manchester United chart of that endless night in Moscow, a very, very wet night when Manchester United and Chelsea both took 105 penalties before eventually John Terry collapsed on the spot and they gave the European Cup to Manchester United. It was actually Thursday morning in Moscow by the time that happened. So, yeah, you do have crazy memories. I do have a memory of standing outside whatever that stadium was called, whichever former Russian dictator it was named after. It's probably been pulled down now by somebody. Waiting for some car that was supposed to come and collect us to take us back to the hotel and getting absolutely drenched. You have weird memories. I mean, the 2005 final wasn't in Istanbul. That's a lie. It was nowhere near Istanbul. It was miles and miles and miles away from Istanbul. So, again, you remember you're staying at this wonderful city centre hotel in this marvellous Turkish capital, and then you remember the hour and a half it took in a car to actually get out to the damn Atatürk Stadium, which looked barely finished by the time we got out there. Somehow the guys that went filled it with atmosphere, and somehow the story unfolded in the way that it did. But, yeah, you talk about memories. We had Steve McManaman in studio that night, and Robbie Fowler just came as his mate. I mean, Robbie just came along for the ride to watch the game with us. And when we got back eventually to this hotel in the middle of the night to toast the victory and just try to clear our heads as to the extraordinary events we'd seen, what was the first thing they mentioned to me? What was the first thing that Robbie said to me? Oh, hey, Clive, you were a bit harsh on Kiel, were you? And I thought, well, crikey, when did that happen? Was that tonight? Yeah, of course it was. And the fact that Smita wasn't ready to come on, sometimes that happens, all that sort of stuff. And Robbie had remembered, he forgot all about the goals and the penalties and everything else and the lifting of the trophy and this time it's for keeps, all of that stuff. He just wanted to give me a little bit of stick for me, who can hardly kick a ball in a straight line, having a go at two professionals, one for being injured and coming off again, and the other for not having his shin pads and being ready to come on.
You'll always stick up for your mates. So, I mean, just on this, just on the charts, and this is maybe a bit of a strange question, but when you draw them up, do you actually find yourself referring, did you ever find yourself referring to them much during commentary? You were kind of swept in the moment, or was it a case of actually writing things down before the game, kind of set them in your memory a little bit? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, there are a few things on that. One, here's a confessional. The prints that we are selling are not, they're not the original charts. The original charts are spread over about probably five or six sheets of A4. And obviously you'd need a big downstairs loo to frame all those and put them all up. So what I've done is I put both teams on one page, and that's the print that we've done. I've handwritten that from the original notes that I had, actually of copies of the original notes that I had, because the originals were auctioned at an Echo do many years ago, some charity do that I went to, and I put the charts up for auction for the charity of the night. So they are an authentic representation of you, of kind of the headline sheet, the top sheet of the prep that I do. How much do you use of it at the night? I mean, I've always said any more than 10-15% and you're probably boring the audience. As I said, the penalty shootout chart that you prepare, I mean, what are the odds of a football match going to a penalty shootout? Probably 10-1, maybe longer than that. So you are doing 2 or 3 hours work on the off chance that this happens. You're not going to use a single syllable of that if the game isn't drawn and goes to extra time and to penalties. So, I mean, if you've got any ambition to be a commentator, if you want to do a job where all of your work sees some kind of fruition one day, don't become a football commentator, because probably only 10, maybe 15% of the prep that we do should hit the air. Otherwise, you should have a crawler going across the bottom of the screen. You've heard, we've all known, heard those commentators, I've bloody well done this research, so you're bloody well going to hear it. That's not good commentating from my point of view. But I also think, Andy, it's a bit of a psychological prop. And I think the reason they are so neat is that, you know, just before whoever Mark Pugacz, whoever it is, hands to me, and the red light comes on, I look down at those notes and I say to myself, mate, you've done the prep. You've done, if it all goes pear-shaped, you know, if it goes tits up because you, you know, you mess up on the night, then you've only got yourself to blame. But at least you've done all the prep that you need to do. So from a confidence point of view, I know more about that game than any of the 20 million viewers who are tuning in to watch it. And that is my job. That's what I'm required to do beforehand. The skill, if there is such a thing, is how you use the prep, how and when you use the prep. And as I say, if more than 10, 15% of it actually hits the airwaves, then the people at home are probably throwing stuff at the screen by half time.
This is what I'm saying about preparation. I mean, you talked about the odds of going to penalties. Does it sometimes feel like Rafa Benitez, Newcastle training all week to keep a clean sheet against City and conceding after 2 minutes? And it all goes,
Plan B. Yeah. Plan B. Oh, no. I mean, at half time in Istanbul, I had not prepped record Liverpool defeats in Europe. I had not prepped. I knew that I'm just about old enough to have some vague recollection of the 1960 European Cup final when Real Madrid scored 7. I kind of knew that was the record. Interestingly, I had there another chart, which is European Cup final records, which I updated every year. And on there, every year, religiously at the top, fastest goal ever scored in a European Cup final. And sure enough, you know, one year it's going to come true. I had the same for the FA Cup final when dear old Louis Sahar scored for the team that play in blue. And it, all of that prep had done year after year after year. And you almost think, yeah, I can actually use this stuff, you know. I can actually. So even though Paolo Maldini scored, it was a bit of a disappointment. I did have the stat for the fastest goal that ever been scored in a European Cup final there to hand. Every other year, it had gone to the final. What goal always goes to the final and never gets used? The loser's ribbons and my stat on the fastest goal that's ever been scored in a final.
Well, you managed that to get
it. It had actually got used. So, yeah, as I say, bit of a comfort blanket, a bit of a safety net, bit of a confidence boost, bit of a psychological thing, and, yeah, 10-15% of that stuff hopefully is of some value to use. But I hadn't prepped the situation I found myself in. So literally during the halftime in Istanbul, I was busily looking through record books and so on, trying to find record defeats, because it was 3-0 going on 33 at halftime, and it looked like it might be 33 by the end.
Talking about, and we'll wrap this up in a minute, just because we're talking about that final in particular, and you've seen a lot of football, and we all know how brilliant Liverpool are at the moment. And I've always wondered, because of Rafa's stoic nature, and you look at the teams that Liverpool side knocked out, you look how good Juventus were, Chelsea were, Milan, and if you put Rafa's best 11, following Rafa to the letter against Jurgen Klopp's 2000, not this year's team, last year's team. How does it end up? What's the score? How does it go?
Well, Liverpool played better in the 2007 final than they did in the 2005 final, in my opinion. I remember watching the whole of the Istanbul final back in prep for the rematch 2 years later. And probably somewhere in my mind, I had thought that once Liverpool had scored the 3 goals to get back to 3-3, that it had been an even match from that point onwards. It really wasn't. They played okay for the rest of normal time, but extra time was totally Milan dominated. And, you know, if a boxing referee had been scoring that fight and it ended 3-3 at the end, he'd have put the Milan hand up in the air, because they'd won far more rounds than Liverpool had. It was a freakish match in so many respects. I mean, don't ask me to name names, but in many respects, I think about 5 or 6 of the Liverpool players deserved 2 or 3 medals each, and 5 or 6 of them really didn't deserve a medal at all. It was a night when the likes of Stevie and Jamie played like three men. And Stevie played in three different positions on the night, you know. And there were some terribly disappointing individual performances in Liverpool Red that night. But still, you know, Jimmy clears one off the line when it really, really counted. You know, Jertsy makes a save the likes of which we've never seen before and he couldn't possibly account for or describe. And somehow, a little bit like, you know, dear old 1999, when it seemed fated somehow that Manchester United would get there in the end somehow. So the same was true in 05 with, you know, not just Stevie's goal against Olympiacos, but the other two goals beside. You know, they needed three goals there, two of them in the last 10 minutes. I mean, some Liverpool fans would struggle to name the scorers of the two other goals. And then the ghost goal and even the nature of the victory against Juve with Sammy volleying a goal with his left foot when he wasn't even in the league team. There was a sense of what was meant to be. So to answer your question eventually, I mean, if you want to make a comparison between Liverpool teams of the past and this team, you shouldn't be going back to 2005 or to 2007. You should be going back to the 1980s. I mean, that's how good this team is.
Wow.
I mean, I kind of left Radio City in, sort of 89, 90, I sort of moved on to Granada Television. So up until that time, and Liverpool had a really, really good team at that time. And it was a bit of a dilemma trying to work out whether people like John Barnes and Peter Beardsley figured in the greatest all-time Liverpool team then, because I'd grown up with the team in the late 70s and early 80s. And then you were struggling to find a place for Billy Liddle and, I don't know, maybe in St. John. But really, you know, if you're talking about great players, truly great players, great's an overused word in football. How many great players have played for Liverpool? Probably 10, something like that. Six or seven of them were in that team in the late 1970s and early 80s. And there were times when four or five of them were on the field at the same time. Now, that is one heck of a team. Really, it was one. Look how many, if you're fed up of hearing your dad or your uncle or your granddad tell you, look how many times they won the Premier League year after year after year. But does Virgil van Dijk get in that team? Yes. Does Alisson get in that team? Yes. Does Sadio Mane and Mo Salah get in that team? I think so. I mean, there's some real competition, but yeah, I think so. And there are a couple of others who are knocking on the door besides. So, you know, that would be a match really worth watching. If you were to take, you know, the finest Liverpool team, which would have, if we're talking about greats, it would have Rush in it, it would have Dalglish in it, it would have Souness in it, it would have Hansen in it, it would probably have Clements in it. If you're talking about truly, truly great players, if you pitch that team against this team, and this team play like it did against Palace last week, like it played at Leicester at the start of the year, like it played for so much of last calendar year, then you've got a match. In terms of know-how and sheer winning mentality, you would have thought the old team might just shade it. But, I mean, the way they've won this title this year, I mean, how many games have Liverpool won this season which were really borderline, games that not only they could have dropped points in, but games they could have lost? I think at least a dozen, maybe more. I mean, we're genuine peril in maybe a dozen or more games that they went on to win. So they've even found that winning mentality that the old team have. So, boy, you've got a game on your hands there. And I think it goes to extra time and penalty. In fact, I'm going to go and prepare my penalty sheet right now, Andy, for that game.
Brilliant. Clive, as ever, absolutely fantastic. So just once again, commentarycharts.com, right? And it's not just, we haven't mentioned as well, it's not just the pinching, you can also get them framed as well. That's correct, isn't
it? Yeah, commentarycharts.com, go and have a look. We've got two Liverpool finals on there. We've got 05 and 2019. You can buy them A4, which is how they're written, but they blow up, because my writing is so neat, they blow up really quite nicely into an A3 size. So you can buy either of those rolled, or we will frame either for you too. I mean, Stevie G's got one of 05, Jamie Carragher's got one of 05, et cetera, et cetera. They love them. And can I let you into a secret? Because Jamie has got another match which is available on commentarycharts.com. I wonder if anybody can guess what it is.
Clive, brilliant. Thanks for coming on. That's been Andy Heaton for the Weekender. Back to the studio.
Neil Atkinson and John Gibbons to talk to you about Harry's, who remain doing the absolute business as it goes on right the way through here. So we'll get it all out the way early. It's harrys.com/Anfield. harrys.com/Anfield. And the trial set is £3.95 if you do want to have a go at that and then go from there. So it's harrys.com/Anfield, John. And we've been doing stuff now with Harry's for many a year. And ultimately, the reason why people keep coming back and the reason why I keep going back to Harry's is because it is a, you know, it's a really, really good product. It's a very, very fair price. It's a good thing to sign up for and see if it goes well for you.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, we're grateful to them for supporting us for so long. And as you say, the reason that they have is because people keep joining up and we've had really good feedback. So yeah, if you want to get involved, you know, Neil's give you the gist there, harrys.com/Anfield. And we're both users, and I'm particularly a big fan, as they always say, of the Rich Lathering Shave Gel.
Well, The arc of history has vindicated me on my cynicism around the Travel Blade cover, as we don't go anywhere anymore. You know, I'm with you on the shave gel 100% to the absolute business, but this Travel Blade cover now, I mean, it's I always felt it was relatively redundant in that, what are you actually doing with your blades whilst you're traveling if you need a cover for them? But also right now, you know, it really is truly redundant. Now, that isn't to talk anything else down. It's a lovely razor with a great handle. It's got five precision engineered blades in there as well, and there's the trimmer blade too. It is the absolute business, genuinely. Me and John do both use it. It's got the Rich Lather and shave gel. All of it is great. But yeah, that Travel Blade cover at the minute, I mean, maybe they shouldn't include it, make the postage lighter.
Well, you never know. Some of our listeners might be different. They might be up and down the country, you know, selling advertising or something, selling shirts. They might need,
I just like to leave ours, John.
I know. Do you know what? I found a mobile phone charger the other week, and I looked at it like, you know, like you found an old footy sticker or something. I was, yeah, all like misty eyed and
like a battery pack.
Yeah.
Who would ever need this ever again, you thought to yourself. Honestly, I can hear the Merseyrail trains because of where I live, and I haven't been on board Merseyrail literally for, it is now longer than 3 months. I've not been on a train for longer than 3 months, any train anywhere, and I think this could be the longest I've ever not been on a train in my life.
Yeah, makes you think.
It does make me think, John. I'm thinking a lot. And this is, you know, there's stuff going on this weekend, obviously, that I don't particularly want to get into right now, but there's stuff going on this weekend, but I weirdly don't fancy it either. I'm in a really sort of strange place. So yeah, Travel Blade covers at the moment, they feel alien to me, but a quality shave on the other hand doesn't. And the really weird thing about all of this is I've become really quite, I mean, I don't look at it right now, but that's because I'm not on anything yet. But I've become really fastidious about my timings for when I'm going to have a shower, have a shave, in terms of when I'm going to get recorded. Whereas normally, and I actually sort of quite enjoy the process, whereas normally when you're in work and you've just got to get in first thing in the morning, it's all a bit of a rush job. Whereas this now is part of that, like Harry's have become part of my daily routine.
No, absolutely. I'm glad it's improved, yeah, your grooming schedule. Another win for Harry's, another win for Jeff and Andy. Not what they expected when they set it up all those years ago, but you know.
Just two ordinary guys who were fed up with lockdown. No, overpriced razors. And they were going to go from there.
Exactly.
So yeah, listen, if you haven't signed up with Harry's yet, do genuinely think about it. It is, there's a thing here, they don't like you to firstly mention competitors when you do this stuff, which I totally understand. And even in a really strange sense, people are a little bit reluctant around comparisons, but I'll make one quite freely and say it's well better than anything else, and it's just dead convenient. So well better than anything else is quite the endorsement, but I'm going to make it.
What a strap line.
Yep. harrys.com/Anfield. Well better than anything else. Neil Atkinson with Jason Lee, who's on the PFA Equalities Education Executive, and to talk about, first and foremost, the study that's come through around terms that are used by commentators and co-commentators. And Jason, it's in a sense somewhat, I suppose for want of a better word, gratifying to get confirmation of something that has, you've sort of felt, I'm sure you have, and I've always been conscious, I've been conscious last few years of it almost on an anecdotal basis, that this bias in language around footballers is used within commentary and punditry, because it's been absolutely crystal clear for a period of time now, but getting it actually confirmed by these numbers is significant.
Yeah, we realise the importance of collating this information, which is not easy in itself, but we was able to work with Run Repeat, Danny McGrath, and he, you know, we've been speaking for a great period of time, and it's something I had in my mind during my playing career. Certainly haven't spoken to my peers and those that I play alongside and those current players, that is, there's always been this feeling that there's an element of unfairness in the way, you know, you're depicted for doing similar things on a football pitch, and kind of stereotyped, really, and that can kind of go against you in maybe in your later career when you want to go into captaincy and management, or, you know, you want to move into another area of importance and maybe not be respected because, you know, for the majority of your career, maybe you've been disrespected.
One of the early examples of this that I really noticed in the context of doing the Anfield Rap was when Raheem Sterling broke through. And I couldn't get over, for a player as young as he was when he started playing for Liverpool, how unbelievably tactically aware he seemed to be. Like, he had this almost uncanny knack to know where was the right place to be on the pitch. And I even still feel now, to be quite honest with you, Jason, it's almost a side point, but I think he should be used through the middle of the pitch more often because of his ability to bring people into play and the way he reads the game. But what I remember seeing was, from all the coverage and every single way he was written about, he was constantly written about in terms of his pace, in terms of this idea he was some sort of dynamo. Whereas one of the things about that, you know, it was obviously accurate that he was quick, but one of the things I just remember sort of thinking when I was watching him was, yeah, but this is, for a lad who's 18 years old, this is one of the cleverest footballers I've ever seen, and I didn't see it get written down anywhere in mainstream media.
Well, listen, this is why Pep loves him. If he was Spanish, he would have fitted straight into that Barcelona team, wouldn't he? You know, he's diminutive, he is intelligent, he takes up good positions, he has got better. And you do get better with age, and you do become more experienced and maybe calmer in front of goal. So to expect the finished article of a young player, which is what some people do, they kind of target your weaknesses and as opposed to, you know, oh, you don't finish enough and that and the other. And he's 18 years of age. Well, he's not going to be the player at 18 that he is now. He has evolved into a world-class player. But yes, you know, to stigmatise people and say, look, pace and power, that's all he's got really, he's got nothing else to his game, he's really disrespectful, because, you know, he works tactically on his game. You don't just get into those positions in matches, you do have to work about it, you have to be methodical and have a full process. And yeah, it just seems unfair in that respect, because other players may get, you know, treated differently, i.e. the Phil Foden's.
Yeah.
You know, that's another example of an excellent player, and he's described, I think, in a different way. I don't know if he's as quick as Raheem, but, you know, they're both quite diminutive. They're both very tactically proficient, technically well. They fit in perfectly to what Pep's trying to do, tiki-taka football.
When you talk about it in terms of, again, another really good example for me is Yaya Touré. I've never known a final third player pick the right pass as often as Yaya Touré. Brilliant to keep in possession in the final third, knocks the ball around, and then you'll be told about his pace and his power. And one of the things I wonder about in this, Jason, and you'll have a better sense of this than I will for a number of different reasons, but I always wonder whether or not what we're actually doing at times is taking footballers when they're very, very young because of the race and deciding they'll play a certain position. That we can, you know, this can end up being reductive to eight-year-olds, nine-year-olds, 10-year-olds, that, you know, you'll be, because of the colour of your skin, I think you'll find you're a winger, whereas there could be generations of decent holding midfielders who never even get looked at there because they don't fit that mould. Do you think that's something that goes on right the way down at the very, very bottom of youth coaching?
I think there's always been that, and we call it unconscious bias. I think that's the way to look at it, because when you choose to call people out and say they're racist, people are going to switch off, and we're not saying that. We're saying, if you don't understand that what you're doing may well be unconsciously pigeonholing people, and it's not identified to you, and you're not working with people alongside who can point it out, how are you going to improve? How are you going to realise the errors of what it is you're doing? I played alongside many players who wanted to play in different positions. You know, they wasn't given that opportunity, or they wasn't afforded that opportunity, because guess what? The coach or manager believes they can play somewhere else. It's okay, a coach and a manager saying that, but if you want to play, you know, if you're a big 6 foot plus player and you don't want to be heading the balls and be, you know, that aggressive set of, sort of player, and you still want to be technically, you know, you had Yamobi back in the day, didn't you? You know, he was a big guy, he wasn't mobile. He was always credited for his, you know, his intelligence on the ball. But then maybe you might have a black player who's described as maybe being lazy. You know, you've got Ndoublé down at Tottenham at the moment, who's being described as being lazy and this, that and the other, because, you know, he wants to play the game in a different way. He wants to get on the ball, maybe, and he wants to spray passes. And listen, if you've got pace and power, they are bonuses. They're great traits to have. But let's not assume that only black players or, you know, only dark-skinned athletes have that. I've played with many, many white players who could catch pigeons. You know, but they were never described in that way. It was there was more to them. Do you know what I mean? And I always thought, well, these guys are rapid. You know?
Yeah.
So it's just too easy. I think it's lazy journalism at time. And the reason we did this study and the importance, and there's been more positive than negative regarding it, is journalists and commentators, they've come back and they've said, you know what, it's the first time that someone's actually taken the time to really critique their craft. Because as footballers, you know, we're critiqued all the time. There's data analysis. Your performance is always being assessed. You know, you're not hitting the targets. You're not quick enough. You're not passing well. You're not. So in every industry, as a commentator, you should be critiqued.
Yeah.
You're actually making mistakes and there's things you can improve on. So the majority of guys have taken it in the right spirit and have said, you know what, I really appreciate it. We could benefit from this. We would like to have unconscious bias training. We'd like people to point out things that we can improve on, and it'd be more beneficial in the long run to a lot of people. The listeners are there listening to, you know, you've got a lot of power when you pick up a mic. We've all got a responsibility. People are listening to what you say or what I say, and some people might take you for a pinch of salt, but some people might really believe in what you're saying. So you're gonna have to be spot on, aren't you? Or at least have it in your heart that you've done the research and you're being as honest as you can be in the picture that you're trying to paint.
When you pick up the mic, when you talk there about sort of unconscious bias around younger players, around all players, but younger players there, one of the things that occurs to me is that's where, you know, that those sort of unconscious biased attitudes get sort of set in stone, is when, you know, you listen to 20 years of commentary and punditry that does sort of depict players in a certain way because of the colour of the skin. It's very, very difficult, isn't it, therefore, to challenge that. And that is the very essence of the unconscious part. And that's why a study like this one is as important as it is. You know, it is that sort of challenging of the unconscious part of this.
I think, you know, just as importantly, it's hard to turn around. You know, once that perception has been sown, you're fighting a losing battle, aren't you, to try and turn it around. So, you know, if for 20 years you're labelled this, that and the other, going to be difficult for you for other people to actually see you as something else, and that's the point we're trying to make. So the long lasting effects of this study, the long lasting effects of the way people depict people, you know, they can have an effect on, you know, your future, really, what you want to do, how you shape yourself. You know, there's lots of footballers that you can speak to who will say, you know, they actually thought they were different players to the way they had to play, or they were deep thinkers, but they were never given that opportunity. You know, and they just had to play the game the way a coach said or the manager said. And I understand that you're an employee at the end of the day. But, you know, if you're technically proficient and you want to, you know, you want to go and do something different in your sport, your industry, you should be given an opportunity really to try and explore those areas.
One of the you know, the current movement, which is brilliant to see the Premier League supporting in terms of Black Lives Matter, Jason, one of the things that studies like this one should hopefully do for people again, and it isn't the idea of, you said at the start, of pointing fingers, but it should sort of depict exactly how nuanced and structurally sort of ingrained a lot of this is. I think that's what I think at times some white people do find sort of difficult to deal with, and that they feel themselves, they're a bit like, well, I'm not like that, but it isn't, no one's saying that they are. This is what you've said before about people being defensive. No one's saying that they are. No one's trying to point the finger and make those accusations. It's more the idea that this stuff is unbelievably nuanced. It's exceptionally structural. And it is going to take generations to undo. This is not a moment, this. It is instead a movement.
It's all connected. I mean, we had to time when we put this piece out, there's so much going on, and I think that's part of it. You know, you have to time and then hit the media across the area, you know, at the right time, because they have their different stories regarding, you know, Project Restart. That would have been a big thing. And then it's Black Lives Matter. And sometimes you know, what you're trying to tell gets lost in, you know, in whatever the latest news cycle is. But it's all connected, and it's about being open-minded, you know, openness, inclusivity. That's what I'm talking about. You've got to listen. If someone's telling you, you know, we feel discriminated against, and that's, and I use the word discrimination. I mean, race is something that's important to me because of the color of my skin, but for other people, it's going to be, you know, gender, sexuality, religion. You know, I'm all for all of that. Discrimination, if someone's telling you more often than not, I'm actually not happy with what you're saying or the way you're treating me, we owe them a duty of care to listen to what they're saying and not to take it with a pinch of salt and say, well, it doesn't affect me, it affects you, so I'm going to get on with my day-to-day. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think that within that, you know, there's also, it's a matter of sort of asking people to make an effort to imagine a little bit, yeah, you know, that I think, exactly. I think a lot of this stuff sort of points back at a, the other thing that sort of ingrains is a level of sort of moral and intellectual laziness around it, Jason. I know that's sort of, I think that Clive Tilsley's used the word lazy around some sports commentary, yeah, in the context of this, and I think it's a really interesting way to describe it, that at times people just, you just become a little bit lazy, a little bit secure, a little bit, well, you know, you don't have to contemplate what you're doing. And again, what reports,
yeah,
like
challenged.
This, yeah,
that's the point. No one's challenged, or not, people are not challenged often enough. So the feedback from this has been really, really good. The fact we're talking today, positive.
Mm.
If we can keep putting that message out there, if we can keep ensuring people are getting... I mean, if you talk to people in the right way, listen, I found that, you know, if I was screaming and shouting and being militant, people would shut off straight away. They wouldn't be interested in what I have to say. So I know to approach people in a different tact. We all have our good and bad days. Sometimes we don't have the patience to explain ourselves to somebody else. But invariably, if you explain yourself in an articulate way, it's hard for somebody not to take on board what you're saying, or at least give you or afford you the opportunity to, you know, to share your knowledge. So people that are listening to me at the moment are being open-minded, which is great. They're understanding that I'm not trying to force it down their neck. What we're talking about is something that we think will benefit you, will benefit people that you work with, people that you come into contact, and people will be feeling a lot more included, you know, within their environment. It's going to be a better environment for people to work in, because at the moment, you know, things are quite toxic, you know, with racial tension and politics and this, that and the other. Things can get out of hand very, very quickly, and we just don't want that.
Okay, thank you very much, Jason. Let's move back over.
It's John Givens with Neil Atkinson and Steve Hoddesall, and we're here to talk about the football pools. But before all that, as we've got Steve on, Liverpool are English champions. Last night didn't go great, but generally speaking, you must be made up. Obviously, you're a Liverpool fan, but also do a lot of work with the club as well. So forget about last night for a minute. You just must be sort of, you know, delighted that your team and your work have won a competition.
Oh, John, you've not had me on all season, then you get me on today. But of all days. Yeah, I'll just sum it up. Absolutely delighted, because, you know, the last week there's been so much to celebrate, hasn't there? And most Liverpool fans walking around with a smile on their face and looking at what has been an astonishing achievement. I mean, basking in the brilliance of this side, but brought a little bit back down to earth by the game against Manchester City. Liverpool are going to be slightly miffed, aren't they? I mean, you don't want to lose your title rivals. But I suppose it's a case of just write this one off. Liverpool's season has been that good and still 20 points ahead. I mean, that puts it into some sort of context, doesn't it?
No, absolutely. And it's been a brilliant season, hasn't it, Neil? And context, you know, is important. And it's not the end either. There's more games to come, and we could still get that points total. And yeah, there's loads more football left.
Yeah, I think that as long as the three lads who play up front to remember to A, control the ball, and then B, kick it in the goal. And I'm no tactical expert, but controlling the ball and then kicking it in the goal helps. And they were specialists at not doing that yesterday. Then you know, things will be absolutely fine. I don't know. I wonder if they were just all a bit weird about it yesterday psychologically, and that's, it's good to have got that out the way, I suppose, you know, from the manager's point of view, because to me they did look. they looked more keyed up than they have all season. And that's a really strange thing to think. You know, they've won the thing. They've got the job done that they've been, we've all been in it for. And they seemed so ramped up. And it was, in the end, it was counterproductive. Maybe they were just hugely, that they had to be so keyed up because of the circumstance. I don't know. But it was really, really strange to see Liverpool play that hurried, to play that sort of uncontrolled at times, when all the way through the season, it's all been about control and it's all been really, really assured.
Have you found the return of football generally, Steve? I mean, obviously you've covered the sport and obviously watched it for a long time. None of us quite knew what to expect. I've watched more than I thought. I think I've watched a lot of games. How have you found it, sort of without fans in the stadium generally?
I think it's taken some getting used to, hasn't it? It's very odd. I went to my first game this week, which was a Preston game, so I got to experience an empty stadium, and the bizarrest of things happened. The reporter next to me was doing an insert into a radio show, and he was talking about David Nugent, who was down on the touchline, and Nugent actually heard him, turned round and pointed at him. And this was with 15 minutes of the game gone. I've never, ever seen that in 20 years of covering football. And then he looked at me and he said, is he pointing at me? I said, well, you just talked about
him. Yeah, Nugent's not having that, is he?
Well, he had some very odd boots on. But yeah, it's taken a little bit of getting used to, but it is becoming the norm, isn't it now? Although, when I was watching the Man City game, I couldn't get used to that idea of the giant video screen with fans sat behind the goals.
Too weird.
Alisson Becker and there's some City fans sort of behind him gesticulating, and it's all just a bit wrong, isn't it?
That's where it all begins to look like something from a dystopian sci-fi. That one, that's where that I'm sort of all right with. I'm on board with the fact that there's no one there, but these jumbo television screens that are broken into sixes or 12s, that's the one where I'm like, I'm not sure about this, to be honest with you. This now does feel like, have they won the Hunger Games so they get to sit there? Do you know what I mean? I'm not comfortable with it at all.
Oh dear. No, it is all taking a little bit of getting used to, but it is nice to have football back. And also nice to have the pools back as well. The Football Pools has been a Liverpool institution for nearly 100 years now, and we're going to be partnering with them for the rest of the season. And I mean, just on that, Steve, as in the Football Pools, it is a Liverpool institution, isn't it? It's been here for so long, and all of us have got memories of it, fond memories of it growing up.
Yeah, we love the Football Pools. I mean, for people of a certain age, well, I'm 48, and I remember the guy knocking on my door midweek, and the sort of the family feel of all putting some crosses next to games we thought would be draws. I mean, actually, choosing 8 draws, I remember as a kid thinking, that's just dead easy.
Yeah.
But then within a few years, it became quite apparent that wasn't. But actually, yeah, still going strong. You can have a look online, and most definitely an institution, nearly 100 years old, absolutely fabulous.
I like that Steve said when a kid he thought it was easier than realised. That was me 2 weeks ago, to be honest with you, Steve. I was like, get a smash this.
Yeah. How much money? I've spent half of it already.
Yeah, spent that £3 million jackpot in my head. I did not win, but you might. If you go to footballpools.com/TAW, that's footballpools.com/TAW, and play and get involved. It is good fun. It's testing your football knowledge, but you can just pick random numbers as well. To be honest, I did a little bit of both. It's only £1 to play, or you can subscribe. They encourage you people to subscribe, and then it takes it out every week for you. And you can win big money. It's meant to be fun, but it's, as I say, Neil, it's been around for so long in Liverpool. It's nice that it's kind of still going, and we're really delighted to partner with them.
We are indeed Liverpool businesses, and certainly at times like these, but I think in general it's true anyway. You know, I think it's important Liverpool businesses work with one another as much as possible. The city matters, and we know the city matters. That's part of what we're about. So, yeah, it is a good thing, and it's good for the city in general, and I think that stuff always matters to us, and it feels like it matters to them. And as I say, it should matter to Liverpool business in general.
Yeah, so that's the footballpools.com/TAW, footballpools.com/TAW. Pick the draws from the games this weekend, and you could win yourself some money for your, I'm sure, amazing football knowledge. But thanks a lot to Steve for coming on, and now back to the main show.
It's Neil Atkinson and Gareth Roberts, and yesterday, Gareth, we're having this chat on Friday, you went to Anfield first thing in the morning, it's fair to say, and you spoke to Wendy Simon, Deputy Mayor of Liverpool, Peter Moore, the CEO of Liverpool, and Merseyside Chief Constable Andy Cook, just about Sunday really, and everything that the club want to see happen, the city wants to see happen as well.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, look, we know, and we talked about it ourselves, that, you know, things got out of hand last weekend around how Liverpool winning the league was celebrated. And there are concerns now, hence, you know, some media being invited to Anfield the other day. There are some concerns that people will congregate again. And there was also some representatives of public health down there also, because, you know, anyone that is following the statistics, and I know it's not for everyone for obvious reasons, everyone's dealing with this situation in their own way. But, you know, there are still some worrying statistics around Liverpool, around Merseyside and around the North West. And while we can say, and I have said myself, that there are mixed messages out there, certainly, you know, bars, restaurants and pubs opening this weekend and things like that. The tweet we saw from the Treasury, in general, stuff that comes out of the Prime Minister's mouth. I think, as comes across in these interviews, there is an appeal to common sense here as well. There is an appeal to people to, yes, you know, you have the option to go out. You have the option to go and celebrate. You can go to your friends. You can gather in groups of six. All the things that we know, we've heard and have been drummed into us. But it shouldn't be in thousands, in hundreds. It shouldn't be at the expense of the community of Anfield as well, which I think we can say it probably was on Thursday night. And equally, you know, with what we saw up here at the Pierhead, it's not how we want to see our city treated. It's not how we want to see buildings that we hold dear treated. And it's give people an opportunity to fire bullets at Liverpool, Scousers, Liverpool FC, the full it. So basically, I think what everyone's saying, everyone's on the same page that, you know, we don't want to give everyone that opportunity once again.
So you spoke to Andy Cook, he's coming up. You spoke to Peter Moore, but you started off with Wendy Simon. And what was it that you'd asked her?
Yeah, first of all, speaking to Wendy Simon about why they are appealing to fans to stay at home this weekend.
I think it's really important that the message is about celebrating at home, you know, protecting each other, keeping our city and the wider city region safe are extremely important. You know, we've seen what has happened in Leicester this week. You know, there are a lot of people who are really suffering because their relatives are either in care homes, they're in hospital, they can't go and visit. You know, we have to be mindful that, you know, this is an unknown virus. We don't know how long it's going to be around, when a peak will come, if it comes. And so following those guidelines are really, really important, and particularly, you know, not congregating, you know, in crowds and big numbers. There's been some relaxation, you know, so people can, you know, celebrate in the garden, you know, with a number of family and friends, and just save the time when everyone can get together and really enjoy a proper celebration.
Yeah, there was 750,000 people on the streets last season when Liverpool won the Champions League, around about 7,000 on Friday night. So that's roughly 1%. Do you think it's important not to demonise football fans?
I don't think it's about football fans at all. We've seen crowds, you know, on beaches, we've seen crowds in parks, we've seen illegal raves. I think the message is to everyone. I think, you know, as you say, the majority of fans did, as was asked of them, of the club, and how they would want to do anyway. You know, fans are people with families, you know, with loved ones. They want to celebrate at home, of course. They want to be together. It's a fantastic achievement after 30 years. But yeah, it is a small amount, but that small amount could have such a massive impact when they go back into their communities and are mixing with other people.
You know, we're all here today, various bodies, to talk about, encourage people not to come down here at the weekend. I just wonder how much you thought it was a bit of a mixed message in terms of what's coming from central government, in that, you know, this weekend people, if they want, are allowed to go back to restaurants, bars and pubs.
Yeah, I think it is really difficult for people. I think sort of people not understanding. I think sometimes messages are coming out really quickly. There's no time for people to sort of absorb that, know what that means. People are desperate to see their friends and family. You know, they've been away from them for so long. And I think, you know, that's different to really big mass gatherings of people wherever that's happening. And I think the more people see people about, the more things are relaxed. People begin to, you let your guard down, don't you? It's human nature. And I think, you know, as a city, as people, we're very touchy-feely. You know, and it's really hard for people not to be close. We've worked so hard as a city to try and protect businesses, to try and keep people in employment. You know, we don't want another spike.
The club, Spirit of Shankly, various bodies have done lots of work about sort of being respectful of the community which this football club's in. One thing that really struck with me in the week when people were talking about it on social media, what happened on Thursday with the outpouring of emotion when Liverpool win the league, a lot of people headed down here. Obviously, it had a lot of people on the streets around the ground. Someone was posting to me saying, you know, I look after elderly people, and there were people here till 5 a.m. and, you know, obviously the streets ended up a little bit of a mess. I mean, there's nowhere to actually go to toilets around Anfield, so you don't have to, you can do the maths there. I think there's a message, isn't there, as well, just about being respectful of this community.
This is people's homes, yeah. You know, they live here, you know, they've lived here all their lives, the families have. Certainly the club's done a lot of work in trying to build up some of those relationships with the community and listen, you know, to what they've got to say. And I know the fans, you know, are really appreciative of, you know, sort of being part of that work as well, and having a joint message. I think that's really, really important. You know, you might be a key worker, a nurse, and there's partying going on till 4 o'clock and you're in an acute ward. Would you want somebody absolutely shattered looking after your loved one? And I just think people get carried away with that emotion, don't they, at the time. I think, to be fair, you know, up until the last couple of weeks, people were really, at times when people thought there might be, you know, a pinch point, there wasn't. Yeah. And I think the mixed messages haven't helped. I think people couldn't be clearer about gathering in large groups. I think sort of that message in the city, you know, from the club and beyond, has been really, really clear.
So Peter, put a message out to fans this weekend then to not come and gather around Anfield for the Aston Villa game. I mean, I guess my first question to you is, it's totally understandable that the club take this stance, that they put this message out there. Jürgen's done the same. We've all read his letter and all the rest of it. Yep. How difficult is it for you, though, as a leader at the club, to be putting these messages out there on the weekend when bars, restaurants, pubs and everything else are opening up?
Well, it's not difficult because it's common sense. People are dying around the world. Yeah, as you know, I'm a dual citizen. I keep a very close eye on what's going on in America right now. The state in which I spent most of the time in America is California, which was shut down again last night. That's tens of millions of people said, stay home. Bars are now closed. Restaurants are closed. Everything that was open has been shut down again. Why? Because people didn't social distance. The R rate has gone up. I don't want that to happen in the UK, and I certainly don't want that to happen in Liverpool. Yeah, it's Super Saturday or whatever it is tomorrow, and I think it's important people get out and enjoy themselves, particularly after what we've been through for the last 3-4 months. But my only message, I would implore you to think of your mum and dad, your nana and your granddad. If you think you're immortal and immune to this, fine, and you've got to think of them. And so I don't want people to go out tomorrow and forget what we're going through, not just as a country, but as a global situation here, which is, unfortunately, millions of people infected. I think it's 8 million people now, and 500,000 people dead. And let's not be a contributor to that.
And we saw some spontaneous celebrations on Thursday night when it was confirmed Liverpool were champions for the 19th time, which is obviously fantastic.
Yep.
But what isn't fantastic, and what is something that I know you've worked on, everyone's worked on at the club, it's a message we've tried to get across at the Anfield Wrap as well, is, you know, Liverpool Football Club's in a community, it operates in a community. And I was saying in one of the other interviews that, you know, one thing that really hit me when I was getting messages about what unfolded on Thursday and Friday was one fella who said, you know, I live in Anfield and I look after elderly people. And, you know, stuff was going on till 4 and 5 in the morning, and those people couldn't sleep and all the rest of it. And, you know, and obviously we saw the streets in a little bit of a mess and things like that. And, you know, that sort of undermines all that work that's being done about respecting the community that Liverpool Football Club's in.
The night of Friday night in particular, Thursday night was bad enough, Friday night in the pier head, I turned on CNN and the lead story there was the fireworks hitting the Liver building. And the lead story was ridiculous images of somebody snorting cocaine on a policeman's helmet. That's not what I want my football club or my city to be seen around the world. And my friends, via whatever social platform they were on, were pinging me, said, is this what's going on over there? And you know, I've got friends that, as I said, are locked down, haven't left the home, and yet they see images of young people. Look, I get the spontaneity, but 2 weeks from now, there's going to be an issue about that. We can't do anything about that now. All we can do is say, stay home. Do not come near Anfield on Sunday. Do what you should be. Watch the game at home. And certainly, I can't understate the fact that we've worked so hard to get back to football. People, you know, if you'd have walked in my shoes for the last 3 months, incessant meetings, fighting the, you know, null and void brigade, the curtail points per game, asterisk brigade, the hashtag tainted title brigade, and we've won.
One last one from me, Peter. You mentioned that how great the Kop looks there, and it looks fantastic dressed with all the flags from supporters. You know, you don't need me to tell you about the sort of passion and pride for Liverpool in the city, how much football means to people. It's a really strange situation for fans not being allowed to get into grounds and watch their football team and be there for the big moment when Liverpool win the league and all the rest of it. Have there been any discussions, even tentative discussions yet, about how possibly fans could return to grounds?
Look, you know, somebody said next week fans can come in. We wouldn't be ready, you know, so you have to plan and think strategically of whether it's 3 months, 6 months, a year from now. The team here is already thinking through what we can do once the UK government says, let's start bringing. I'm on the executive board of the European Clubs Association, and one of the great things of that is we learn about all of the other leagues and what's going on. People are starting to come back, depending what the infection rate is in particular countries. So one of the benefits of being, you know, behind the curve a little bit is we'll learn from other countries or the leagues or the clubs. And, you know, I do have this benefit of being part of this board that is seeing primarily smaller countries, but saying, we're going to bring 500 in, we're going to bring 1,000 in. This is how we're doing turnstile management. This is how we're doing concourse and concession management. This is how we're managing the bathrooms. And this is how we're managing transportation to and fro. So yes, we're already thinking it through. Every Premier League club will be thinking it through, because there will come a time when these turnstiles will open again, and we need to be ready for that.
Hey, Andy, and so, you know, you're down here today to give a message to football fans not to come and gather for the Aston Villa game on Sunday.
Very much so. It's important that we do maintain that Public Health England advice, that we do keep our distance. I know everyone wants to celebrate. It's a fantastic achievement. Liverpool have won the title. We've been waiting for this for a long time, but it's not safe to do so. People are still dying. There's a pandemic going on. It's not gone away. It's not going to go away for a little bit yet. There'll be plenty of time to celebrate the success. There'll be plenty of time to see the players. There'll be plenty of time to come to Anfield, which is a fantastic venue to come to, which I come to every couple of weeks as well with my season ticket. We all love the place. Stay away from it from now. It's not the right time to be here. That right time will come, but it won't be for a while yet.
How more difficult does it make the job for the police that bars, restaurants and pubs are opening this weekend?
It makes it really difficult. I understand people want to go out and have a drink and relax. It's been a long lockdown so far. The lockdown is not over, though, so when they do go out, they need to make sure that they're doing the right things. They need to make sure they're keeping a distance. They need to make sure they're drinking sensibly. They need to think of other people, vulnerable people right across Merseyside. Members of our families are at real risk from this. I come to match with my dad. My dad's 80 years old. He's been shielding for a long, long time. He's been in the house for a long, long time. I don't want him to suddenly come down with this terrible, terrible disease because people couldn't behave themselves. And you'd all have family members like that. So think of them before you do the things that you know aren't the right things to do. We've seen some of the issues from that following the pier head, some of the disorder we had in the city centre. That's not Liverpool fans. That is not the right way to be. Let's think of the reputation of the club and the city. Let's think of the health of the people who are at real risk of dying from this terrible pandemic. And let's just, for a few more weeks, months, whatever that time is, let's behave before we start the celebrations.
We saw stuff that at the period that, you know, no one can condone and no one can get behind, and it obviously has generated some, you know, negative headlines for the city, for Liverpool fans and all the rest of it. I wonder, just to try and turn that around a little bit, would you praise the behaviour of the supporters in terms of for the Crystal Palace game, for the Goodison Derby?
Absolutely. Goodison Derby, Liverpool and Everton fans stayed away. Crystal Palace game, Liverpool fans stayed away. That's how it should be. That's what we've asked for. That's what the club's asked for. That's what everyone's been asking for. And it was brilliant. People did the right thing. The issues that happened on the Thursday and Friday. Thursday, people want to celebrate. I understand that. I don't condone it, but I understand it. Friday, that was not the right thing to do. That was a real threat to public health. That was a real threat to public order across the city. And it was a real threat to the reputation of this great city.
ended there with Andy Cook. Gareth, I enjoyed your conversation with Andy, to be quite honest with you. It was very matter of fact. I got the impression that you and him, you know, if the pubs were open, you and him might have gone and got one. Once that was finished, might have gone and got yourselves a pint each. And in there, this, you know, it is worth pointing out, and I think Andy makes his, without saying it explicitly, makes his thoughts clear. It doesn't help that the pubs and restaurants are reopening this weekend on top of everything else. It isn't smooth this, but you know, therefore though, that's the reason why everyone's just gotta keep their heads and make decisions that suit them. No one's forcing anyone to go anywhere or do anything.
Yeah, just be sensible, isn't it? I mean, you look, you know, I liked Andy. I like the fact that, you know, he was open and honest about being a Liverpool fan himself, but then equally talking about, you know, concerns around his own father and things like that. And I think there's a constant series of dilemmas with some of this, and you know, that's added to by pubs being open, because people will think, well, you know, I'm absolutely desperate to see my friends, I'm absolutely desperate to socialise, and you know, that everyone's got their own individual circumstances. I mean, all the conversations that I've had with people this week, you know, have been around, you know, we obviously know ourselves, some people in the trade, but you know, people around Anfield who run pubs and stuff like that, as you can imagine, you know, a lot of that is dependent on the trade that they get from the football, and it simply hasn't been there. So if they've been given the opportunity to open this weekend, then the likelihood is that they're going to take it. Some of them are going to take it. But we just need everyone to put the sensible hat on, everyone to, you know, play by the rules, everyone to enjoy themselves but not go over the top, not go too far, and as I say, not congregate around Anfield. I mean, what I liked, what Andy said also, is that, you know, things that did get out of hand also need to be put into context. So there's been a lot of told you so's and all that flying around. But, you know, Liverpool fans and Everton fans behaved themselves for the Merseyside derby. Yeah. No problems at all around Goodison Park. Liverpool fans behaved themselves for the visit to Crystal Palace. There was no problems around Anfield then. So we've got Aston Villa on Sunday, and we want to be able to say again, Liverpool fans have behaved themselves around Aston Villa. That's all we're saying.
Indeed, that is all we're saying there. Thank you very much to Gareth and to everyone who took the time there on Thursday morning to pull that together at Liverpool, to Wendy, to Peter and to Andy. Let's get back on with the show.
It's John and Neil again, and it's another insert, it's another advert, if you like, and it's another partner. It's a new partner, they're called Babbel, and that's with double B, so it's Marcus, not Ryan.
Really good distinction, John Welling.
I mean, I was going to say not literally, but who knows what Marcus Babbel is up to right now. He could, you know, I know he's dabbled in coaching, but he also could be in languages. He must speak at least two. Babbel are a language school, and they've sent us a few months, so we had a bit of a go. I've just checked with Neil, and Neil hasn't had a chance to have a play around yet, but luckily I have. So you can ask me questions if you want, Neil.
Genuinely, which language did you choose to learn?
I went for French just because I thought that was the one I could remember the best. So I thought I'll have a bit of a head start rather than like go for something completely from scratch. I thought, you know,
you speak un peu of French.
Exactly, yeah. And also, you know, some of it might sort of come back. And it has really, like, oh yes, I remember this in school. And I like it. It was opportune actually, because a couple of my friends started learning languages in lockdown, and I've been a bit sort of jealous of them. Sort of guys who've been furloughed and stuff like that. Yeah, Mick and Andy Clark. Brothers. Wow. what I like about it as well, they sort of compete and stuff like that. See how they get on. And so I was a little bit jealous, thinking, oh, I should do something like that. And then didn't get around of it. And then the Babbel people got me in touch, and I thought, this is a sign, you're going to do it. So I've had a little go, and yeah, I just like the website. It's a lovely, clean website, Neil. You'll love it.
I will have a go myself, and then next time we have a chat about it, I'll have some knowledge. It's a lot of languages. I've seen that much. So I'll go through the languages you can learn. Spanish, French, German, Italian, Portuguese, Russian, Turkish, Dutch, Swedish, Norwegian, Polish, Danish, and Indonesian. That's a lot of choice, and it'll take every fibre of me being, John, not to go for Indonesian.
So you're the opposite of me, aren't you? You're a daredevil. You'll just think, I'll just go into something I've got no knowledge of whatsoever. Whereas I'm mostly conservative.
It's partially that, John, but it's also like Brock's really good at language.
Oh, so you can get one over on her.
I can get her, but also she can't tell me I'm doing it wrong. you know, later on, because she speaks relatively good French. She speaks really strong German and Russian. She picks everything up really fast as well. That's the other thing. Like she really does pick things up at a pace. So yeah. You know, so if I think Indonesian might be the break I need in order to get miles away.
What would be brilliant would be, this involves playing the relative long game, especially in the moments, is learn it and don't tell her, and then go on holiday to Bali, and then just start dropping it in and watch it echo.
Just have Indonesian in my back pocket, maybe for 7 years. 7 years.
Well, that's what Indonesian. I mean, because, like, well, first of all, we're not going anywhere anytime soon. And secondly, you know, why don't we go to Bali, Sam? Do you know what I mean? It's not like going to Wales, is it? It will take a while. But it gives you time to get stuck in on Babbel and see how it goes.
Yeah, definitely. So the reviews on it are really, really strong right the way across. I can see that on the website right now with Babbel. John's enjoying it. And it is supposedly a clean experience, but also... It's nice to, like, I, one of the things I've been thinking during lockdown, it's not the idea even of a lockdown thing, to be honest with you, John, is it'd be quite nice to learn something. I'm worried that this becomes a midlife crisis thing, but it'd be quite nice to actually go through a process of learning a thing or two somewhere again for the first time in what would feel like a while.
Do you know what? It's funny as well, because I think everyone sort of had a bit of a spurt of activity at first with lockdown. Like, they bought a bike or they got some, you know, gym equipment for the house or whatever. And then everyone just sort of, you know, just got a bit normal, you know, routine and stuff. Like, got a bit, I don't want to say lazy, because lazy is the wrong word. But I think more recently people are going, actually, the end is in sight here. This is actually a bit of an opportunity that I might not get again anytime soon. So yeah, if language is for you, I'll add a little go at Babbel and I'm enjoying it. And I'm sure you will as well. Lovely, clean website. Can't stress that enough.
People who are in the trade on giving notes on these things. lovely stuff. All right. All the best to Babbel.
Thanks to our roving reporters there. And we're back in our virtual studio. And I'm still with Cathy Long, with Ian Salmon, with James Sutton and with Paula Murphy. And we're going to look ahead to Aston Villa, because the games do come thick and fast. There's a full programme again, obviously, this weekend, starting with Aston Villa. how are we all going to approach it then? And we'll all sort of pick a team together. This is groupthink. So Jürgen's been on. He said, I want the soundest minds in Merseyside.
and they weren't available, so you found us.
Exactly. So we're going to go... We'll go from our front... We'll go from the front to front three, first of all. So far, he's gone with, the last two games anyway, he's gone with the big front three. So he's gone with Salah, with Firmino, and with Mane. In that very first game, Minamino gets a start. There's also, obviously, the European Cup champion, Divock Origi. And there's a bit of a Harvey Elliott, if someone wants to do something saucy as well. Would anyone make a change first of all? And if so, what?
No, I wouldn't. I think he's got a point to prove now. They've got to win. They've got to win, and they've got to play really well. And I think if he looks arrogant by picking, you know, Elliot or Minamino from the start, I know he wouldn't pick Elliot from the start. But, you know, I think if he didn't go any other than top three, he might sub them if we're doing okay. But no, I think he'll stay top three.
What do you think, James? You're nodding there.
Yeah, I completely agree. I don't think you can make any changes. I think point to prove. I think. Throw them straight back in. Look, it's Aston Villa. Aston Villa are not Man City. Let's make that very, very clear. Aston Villa are in a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
They are in a lot of trouble in a few days' time, because we're going to be going for the jugular. I'd keep the same front three, definitely.
Ian, he will rotate at some point, won't he? You know, you'll see. Maybe all three of those people I mentioned start. Maybe just Harvey Elliott from the bench. But certainly Origi and Minamino, I'd expect to start at least one game between now and the end of the season. Do you think maybe just this one, because of what's happened, he might go with the three main fellas again?
I think because of what's happened to City, he will have that to prove. Yeah. I think he's got to go out there and go, okay, we'll just go and do the job. I think the one person off the front three that I think I'd be most inclined to rest at the moment would be Bobby. I'd like to see Minamino come in and shift there. But I think it's very important that we see all five subs used. Notably, we didn't use all five last night. I think we used four. Chamberlain at half time, and then three stoppages for it. But I'd like to see all five subs used while we can, because I want to see Elliot Minamino get a run out. I'm not that bothered about seeing Divock play. I'm really not. Mm. I can't remember the last time I saw him play. And actually be any good, and I'm including Madrid, because he came on in Madrid, was terrible for 25 minutes and scored one of the greatest goals of all time, so but the drop off when you put Divock on the field now is so pronounced, it's unbelievable, because he's just anonymous.
Yeah. Cathy, are you going for the front three again?
I'm going for the front three, yeah. I'd love to, you know, create an argument about setting a debate, but no, I agree. I'd like to see some of these, you know, I'd like to see Elias Minamino. I agree about Divock as well. I'm not particularly interested in seeing him anymore. We know what he can do and we know what he can't do. And he's sort of, he's diffident, you know, he hasn't got the intensity. You know, and that's not what we need. And I think what we need to do is keep up those levels. And yeah, I'd stick with the front three, and I'd like to see Elliot come on if we've scored a few and we can give him a run out.
Okay, so we've got a front three. Yeah, it's going well. This, who says you can't make decisions by committee? We'll carry on. We'll go into the midfield. Then I'll start with you this time, James. So last night he's picked Fabinho, Henderson and Wijnaldum. There was sort of his cup final team, as I call them, his main fellas for when it really matters. Chamberlain comes on at half time. Obviously, Keita has had plenty of minutes, and he's got a Curtis Jones absent option, and also James Milner, presumably closer than he was on Wednesday. See when he doesn't get anything. So you've got seven to pick from there. Which three are you going for?
Well, obviously Jordan Henderson's first name on the team sheet, that goes without saying. Fabinho again, I think he's been doing really well. I thought he looked a little bit leggy second half yesterday. When he, you know, I think anyone covered themselves in particular glory. Naby Keita, I'd love to see Naby Keita start. I really would. I think he's so close to being brilliant for us. And the attacking threat that he, you know, that the connecting the midfield and the attack, I just think I really, really want to see that. I think he's really, really exciting. And I don't know what else, you know, in a game like this, I think it'd be perfect for him to do some business.
So you're picking Keita, Fabinho and Henderson?
Yeah.
Just to confirm. Okay. Yes. There was lots of nodding by Cathy, so I'll bring Cathy in.
Yay.
Yeah, I think so as well. I mean, I love Ginny. I love watching him play. I think he's one of those players that isn't always appreciated. You know, I think what he does for the team in knitting things together, and I think he's more creative than people think. But yeah, I'd like to see. I think we need to change a few things, and I think Keita, it is the sort of game, as James says, that you should, if he can do it against Villa, you know, if he can't do it against Villa, then we're going to learn something on it. You know, and I think we need to see him do that because he is so close, and he needs the confidence. Clearly, you know, he needs the sort of games where he can get that sort of a boost. So if I'd rest anyone out of those three, I think it would be Ginny. I probably wouldn't rest Fab, but I wonder if the manager might, just in terms of, you know, I don't know if he thinks that. It's hard, isn't it? Like before lockdown, you know, he hadn't had as many games, Fab and stuff, and he wasn't always in the team. But it's hard to know now whether his fitness is just as good as anyone else's, basically, now since lockdown, you know.
Yeah, okay. Ian, who are you picking in midfield?
Well, it all depends how quickly we can register Thiago, doesn't it?
Nice. Let's say he's not available. We don't quite get the paperwork done in time.
Keita. I think Keita's necessary. I think Keita and Gini. I think Gini was great again the first 20 minutes last night, but then was anonymous for the rest of the game, didn't have any real influence on it. Fabinho obviously has moved back to centre-back. There could be a call for playing Fabinho centre-back against it on Sunday, depending on how Gomez is, because I have a worrying feeling that we might see Lovren. I'd rather that didn't happen on the whole. Mm. No disrespect to Dejan.
Some disrespect. Well,
I was showing less disrespect to Dejan before his Twitter became political. And then I was kind of like, oh, you sure, lad? I think we might see Fabinho at the back again at the weekend, rather than Lovren playing, because it seems to be accepted that he will be off at some point. So certainly Keita. Probably Henson Fabinho, but maybe Henson Milner.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Paula?
That's exactly what I was about to say. I would go Milner, Henderson, Keita, definitely. I think what Milner will do is Milner will make sure that communication's tight, everything's tight. Milner will not allow any chaos that we sort of happened and before we got our head together. And I think we need to make sure that nothing stupid happens here. We've really got to go into these. And I think even if, you know, he does a job up to half time and then you think, right, well, let's bring him off and let's rejig it, bit of youth, bit of movement. But what we can't afford to do is to have any mishaps at all in this game. And I think that would be a tight, solid midfield.
Okay, so everyone's going for Keita, which is interesting. I think the manager will as well. Okay, and in terms of the back line, then I'll start with you this time, Ian. Nico Williams has had a couple of little runs and looked impressive. I thought he was another rare positive from the Man City game. Andy Robertson doesn't play the first game. Obviously, Milner does. Comes in after that. So he might be thinking he might give Trent a rest there. Gomez comes off at half-time. But he might want to sort of throw him back in because, he thinks, get that out of your system. Doesn't have it. It's not a good night at the office for Gomez. So, normally the Jürgen Klopp thing, I think, would be to sort of put him back in there. But what would you be thinking in terms of both fitness and also a bit of form as well?
Very similar on that. My first thing would be I would give Nico Williams a start.
Okay.
I think he's done justify it. I think Trent probably could do with the rest. I don't think Villa are going to threaten you as much as anybody else. And anyway, we use our right back to go forward with.
Yeah.
Gomez, as I said, I think there could be a case putting Fabinho in, but I do think putting Gomez straight back in, it's a learning curve for him. He did against City, it's just that, don't grab hold of Sterling. That's all he's got. He's not actually threatening you. If you hold him, you're giving him exactly what he wants. Learn from that. I think he's an intelligent enough player to learn from that anyway. So if you go, probably Gomez and Van Dijk, but possibly Fabinho and Van Dijk, I would be very tempted to give Andy Robbo
a rest.
That's a position where if you're playing Gomez and Fabinho's in midfield, you could put Milner at left back. I wouldn't like to go Williams and Larucci against Villa because I think you're exposing yourself a little bit too much. But I think the third goal, Foden's goal, as gorgeous as it is, part of it is due to the fact that Andy Robbo seems to actually become smoke and run through a player.
Yeah.
Straight through, it's like, what are you doing? So those two lads, Robbo and Trent, both deserve rests, and this could be a game to rest them in.
Yeah, I mean, I would certainly say, Cathy, one of the next three games we're likely to see a Nico Williams start. It's Aston Villa at home, Brighton away, and Burnley at home. And although, you might say, well, those are the games where they might sit deep, so you want the quality of Trent's delivery. At the same time, you're also expecting it to be a nice day for a defender, in terms of not a huge amount going the other way. And so one of those games, I think Nico Williams probably will start. I think there'll be a good opportunity to, to give Trent a rest, but also to reward Nico Williams. This isn't all about Trent Alexander-Arnold. This is about saying to a young lad, You've performed really well, and every sort of step up and every challenge we've thrown at you, including playing the second best team in the country last night, you've done really well, and so we all deserve that start. It's just kind of where it comes.
Yeah, I think for me, the hard decision actually is the wing backs for this game, because it's very tempting to bring in Nico Williams, and I like the idea, like Ian says, of bringing in Milner. To give it the right sort of balance, because it does always seem like this is about balance with this team.
Yeah.
We've seen what happens when we haven't got Robbo. We've got Alexander-Arnold, but without Robbo, it doesn't seem to work. Yeah. So, do you change both of them? But that feels a little bit risky to me. I think the manager might actually stick with the back four and then try Nico Williams maybe against Brighton. You might decide to put Milner in, depends on Milner's fitness. But yeah, I'd be very willing certainly to give Nico Williams a start. Maybe send Andy Robbo back out there and just say sort your head out and stop dodging around like Ian says, like you smoke, like you're invincible. I remember that you're part of this team. So just sort of bombing forward and get a bit of discipline and a bit of organisation back in there. So I think that's probably what's needed. And I wouldn't have Lovren in, but that probably goes without saying.
James,
All right, James. So, what's your back four thoughts?
Similar to the guys, really. I like the idea of changing out the fullbacks. I think give them both a rest. I think Nico Williams has been brilliant. The bits I've seen of him, James Milner. I think a little bit of composure and a little bit of maturity, in that position can't do us any harm. Aston Villa have got very, very little going forward. I mean, they really haven't. You stop, Jack Grealish aside, they haven't got a huge amount. I don't expect us to be tested. And I think you put Joe Gomez straight back in. I thought it was harsh pulling him off at half time against City. I know he was having a bit of a stinker, but you're coming up against Raheem Sterling, who is absolute world class, make no mistake about it. And I think it was harsh taking him off. So I think put him straight back in next to Van Dijk, and then change up the fullbacks, and that's basically it for me, I think.
Okay. Whoever they pick, Paula, we should have enough to be Aston Villa. As James says, the struggling, you know, in terms of, you know, goals and creativity, the allowing a lot of shots as well, and a Liverpool side who will be stung by a defeat. You know, you don't want to be complacent, but at the same time, they should have too much for Aston Villa. Whoever wants five pick.
Yeah, and I think, it's an interesting game this for both teams, because if we'd beaten City. You know, we'd be having a totally different conversation, even if the performance had been the same. And I think if we'd beaten City, we would be far more. I think I certainly would be more prepared to play fast and loose with right. Williams and people like that. But you know, Villa will be fuming, because they will now know that we will not want to just go and have a little kick around because we're champions and all the rest of it. They will know that we've got a point to prove. They must be fuming, because they probably thought, oh, well, if they've won, they do City, you know, we might get a point. They might do a load of subs, but I think it's going to be far more cautious. And I think this is why my head is telling me Milner's going to get a game. If Fabinho stays, I think Klopp will find a way to get him in the back four, because I think more than anything, they'll want to move forward before they concede. If they concede, I don't think they will, but I think Klopp will want to make sure that, you know, we're moving forward. And I do think it will be a fairly easy, if it's not pretty, victory.
Okay. I presume everyone thinks Liverpool are going to win, so I won't ask you for predictions, but I will ask, is anyone watching it in a bar? Is anyone going to an open pub and watching a game of football?
Not sure that's a good idea.
No.
It's an option. I'm just saying it because someone texted me last night. My friend Nick texted me and said, oh, I've got a table at the Shankly Hotel. Do you want to come? And I was like, oh, yeah, that's a thing. Do you know what I mean? Like, I thought like he was talking, you know, he'd stuck it in the back at first. You know what I mean? Like, invite me to a speakeasy. And I was like, I'll be at home doing hot making the post match show. But yeah, it did make me laugh. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's actually allowed. So, but yeah, the look at all your faces suggests, you're not going to.
This weekend will be absolute bedlam.
It will.
I think my first drink at a pub is going to be Wednesday afternoon about 2 o'clock, I think. Go to one of Paul's gaffs when it's nicely spaced out, and try and support him that way, because you do want to support businesses, don't you?
But
you've got to be conscious of these things as well. Thanks a lot to everyone for joining me, obviously for the guys who did the inserts as well, for all of those, and for you guys for listening. That has been the Weekender. Enjoy your weekend. The Reds play again on Sunday. Isn't that fantastic?
Thank you for listening to the Anfield Wrap. Listen, you're probably going to get bored of this over the next few weeks. We're putting this at the end of every show. It's Neil Atkinson here, whether I hosted this show or not, to ask you to vote for us in the British Podcast Awards. To do that, you go to britishpodcastawards.com/vote, and there you'll find it is the Listener's Choice Award, supported by BBC Sounds. If you search for the Anfield Wrap in the box that comes up, you will get the Anfield Wrap, or TAW also gets us the Anfield Wrap as well. So TAW gets us the Anfield Wrap, or the Anfield Wrap in there. And then from there, if you vote for us, you'll then get an email that you'll have to click to confirm the vote. And then from there, you've registered the vote, and we appreciate it very much. We've never won this award in the British Podcast Award. We've come second 3 consecutive years. We discovered that last season we were a little bit closer than we thought last year. Good Lord, not everything works like that, Neil. And so we thought, well, let's give it a real go. We'll give it a big push this time out. So hopefully you've been able to do that for us, and hopefully you're happy to do so as well. We do always appreciate the support in any way in which it comes at the Anfield Wrap, and especially through what's obviously been a difficult time for a number of podcasts, for obvious reasons. Anyway, thank you very much indeed, and take care. Sports Social Podcast Network.